opened up the pant legs and shimmied the prison cottons up my shanks until the elastic waistband was round mine. Then I headed for the pokey. At 9:30 a.m., my 32-and-a-half-hour buzz now turned hangover. I was sitting in the corner of the cell when two people showed up on the other side of the bars. "Mr. McConaughey, I'm Judge Penny Wilcove, and this is criminal defense attorney Joe Turner, unorderly. Unlock the cell door." Now I don't know how in the hell of disturbing the peace call escalated into a Class A misdemeanor resisting arrest and a Class B misdemeanor possession of less than 2 ounces of marijuana. The judge said, "Or why two of our police officers forcibly entered your home without fair warning. I am going to dismiss the disturbing the peace in possession, misdemeanors, and give you a personal recognizance bond on the resisting arrest." I don't understand or agree with how this situation escalated. "Well, Judge Penny, I'm not sure what that all means, but I don't either," I said. Joe Turner, who was the same attorney who successfully defended Willie Nelson years earlier in the possession case, spoke up. "Now, Judge, we all agree that this situation got out of hand very quickly, but you also gotta understand that these policemen literally broke into this man's house while he was playing some bongos in his birthday suit. The resisting arrest was self-defense. I suggest you dismiss it altogether, and my client will plead to the Class C violation of a sound ordinance. As he was indeed banging on those bongos pretty damn loud for 2:36 in the morning." "Deal, case closed," said the judge. "Well, what's that mean?" I asked. Joe pulled out his wallet, grabbed a $50 bill, waved it in my face, then looked at me and said, "Means I'll pay your get out of jail fee and you owe me $50. You're free to go. I've got a car waiting for me in the back entrance, or you can meet the press out front. There's plenty of waiting. Here's a bag of fresh clothes your neighbor dropped off for you." I thanked them both. Got dressed in the laboratory, splashed my face with cold water, and tried to breathe out the blues that were starting to set in. "Why the blues, you ask?" "Well, obviously I was lucky walking out of jail. Only $50. Poor, this didn't happen to everyone who got hauled in on charges like resisting arrest and marijuana possession. The problem was, as I've said, in my family, we didn't get in trouble for committing the crime, we got in trouble for getting caught. I wasn't raised to end up in jail for anything or any amount of time. And even though my offense was one I'd committed many times before and would, many times more I got caught, and for that I felt guilty." Outlaw logic looking for some fearless consolation. I decided to call my mom before I chose which way to leave my first prison stint. Maybe it was the fact that while I was sure she would have no mercy for my circumstance, at the same time, I knew she would pour, drink, and toast to how it was. I got into it. Was it going to be her that answered, or was it going to be that new groupie fan? I didn't know. Turns out it was both. "They what, Matthew broke into your house?" "No, star. You keep your head up," she said. "There is nothing wrong with smoking a little fun stuff and playing your drums naked at night in your own home. Who do they think they are coming into your house like that?" Just what I needed. I hung up and decided to stride toward the media mob out front instead of sneaking out the back. Green light. 2 days later, bongo naked t-shirts were all over Austin. I framed that violating the sound ordinance ticket. The Cornhusker was later dismissed from the force. Joe Turner got the resisting arrest expunged from my file, and I got my virginity back, turning my life of crime around. But my 2-day party had other consequences. With the help of an editor of the local newspaper who carelessly printed a picture of my house with the address on the front page of the Metro section, my residence in Tarrytown quickly became a tourist attraction. Even for the locals, good-hearted people dropped off 6 packs of beer, different kinds of drums, and a lot of weed. It was amusing and kind, but it turned our sleepy little neighborhood street into South Bundy Drive in Brentwood. No more leashless dogs or chasing bouncing balls into the street without looking. Fame can change people, but in this case it changed to place my anonymity gone again. It wasn't fair to me or my neighbors for me to live there any longer, as the peace I'd found on Meadowbrook Doctor was now disturbed. They are heavily protested my evacuation, but I had no choice. Time for goodbyes. Instead of simulators, Miss Hutton. I packed our bags, ducked out of the lease, and headed west again. Note to self, nobody gets in trouble for what they do. They only get into trouble when they get caught. The art is in getting away with it. The outlaw don't live on the edges. Now he lives in the center, cruising through the slipstream. January 2000. With an actor strike looming and a few films since my last box office hit, I needed to get back to Hollywood and start the hustle again. Anyway, I needed to be in the industries I line, work the town, take meetings, be around the creatives that were making the decisions. Neither the box office performance of the Newton Boys Contact Amistad Ed TV and U571, nor my performances in them met or raised the white-hot expectations of Matthew McConaughey in the movie industry. Since The Time to Kill, the first-class dramatic studio offers I was looking for were no longer being offered. I was still a bankable star, but my shine had dimmed. I'd lost some heat, as the industry calls it, and I was losing my hair. With the strike imminent in Hollywood, scrambling to start as many productions as possible before a walkout, I'd gotten above my market value. Cash offered to play the lead opposite Jennifer Lopez in The Wedding Planner. I read the script, it looked like fun. The money was generous and I was ready to work. Shooting started in 2 weeks in downtown Hollywood. I said yes and Miss Hutton. I made our new address, the legendary Chateau Mormont in the heart of Tinseltown. Yep, where Led Zeppelin's John Bonham rode his hog through the lobby, and John Belushi OD'd on Cocaine Bungalow 3. Ready to rock and roll Congress into I cashed that healthy check from the studio. Bought a pair of leather pants and a Triumph Thunderbird motorcycle. Wrote the Chateau or running tab of 120 grand and got a key to my room until whenever I turned it in. Acting in a romantic comedy was different from anything I've done before. Engineered to be light, not lightweight. They're built for buoyancy, and I learned to enjoy skipping from cloud to cloud as one needs to do in order to keep those type of films afloat. I quickly realized that, unlike in dramatic acting, you cannot drop anchor and hang your hat on humanity in rom. Calm lest you sink the ship. I enjoyed this kind of acting. It was all green lights, like a Saturday character in a story that was a series of Saturdays. Back at the Chateau, it was always a Saturday easy street, and I was on it once again. Having committed to my man, now eager to dance with my devils instead of fight them. I was keen to negotiate the Abyss broker a deal with lack of restraint, and see if I could come out the other side unscathed. My days of it be rude not to and I don't have to, so I will lead to many a morning of I don't knows and let's not remembers. You know how it is when you're up to nothing. No good, usually next. Single, healthy, honest, and eligible, I enjoyed the transience of a high-class hotel that promoted mischief transactions, flings affairs, renting to rent, not to own. I wore the leathers, I rode the Thunderbird. I took a lot of showers in the daylight hours, rarely alone. I partook, I embraced the fun, my femen, the curfew-less hours when I wasn't working. I'd read scripts tanning by the pool, write poetry, have a friend over for lunch, take Miss Hud for a walk, go for a run, then get ready to saunter into the Hollywood lights. My life being designed for ease, these nightly adventures could take place on foot, which was a perk considering my affection for liberal libations. I'd meet friends for dinner and ultimately return to the Chateau for late night. Reverie of song dance and the occasional wrestling match. Localizing and customizing once again, I also had a key to the hotel's kitchen, which I conveniently used to cook. 3 a.m. steaks. Note to self. Kiss the fire and walk away whistling. I swallow vitamins with a beer. I do chew more tobacco than I ought to. I crawl around and I chase the moon and I sleep with women who ride in on brooms just so I can kiss the fire and walk away, whistling. Then I got offered the role of Denton Van Zandt in the film Reign of Fire. Van Zandt was a cigar-gnawing, apocalyptic, dragon slayer who ate the heart of every dragon. He slayed and carried a dwarf around on his shoulder. Now the dwarf on the shoulder part later got cut out of the script, but I always loved it. I immediately had an understanding and a need for a character like Vans and a man with a singular constitution alone not doing what he could to survive, rather doing everything he could to deny extinction. An island of a man whose freedom was his isolation. Maybe it was the 18-month hedonism tour I'd been on at the Chateau. The booze, the women, the gluttony. Maybe it was an aggressive recoil to distance myself from the bubbly mendacities of my recent rom. Calm emasculation. Maybe it was both and in some. Either way, I felt like it was time to earn my Saturdays again. I needed some yellow lights. I've been questioning my own existence and searching for meaning in my life for as long as I could remember. But now, for the first time, I was also questioning the existence of God. An existential crisis. I'd got an existential challenge and one I was up for. I didn't as much cease believing in God as much as I doubled down on self-reliance and the responsibility of my free will. I was done with the excuses that fate allows. I was ready to be the boss of me, the one to blame and quit. I needed to own that. It was my hands on the steering wheel. Tired of letting myself off the hook on Easy Street. I was done with unearned forgiveness. feign compassion, the protocol of manners and graces and self-indulgent sentiment. Living for tomorrow when we might just all be raced into the red light. Seem like a fool's errand. Brave enough to say it's on me and me only in my prayers, but still scared enough to keep praying. I gave credit to the notion that it might all be for nothing and I quit doing it for something. If you are there, God, I prayed. I hope you appreciate a man who won't retreat from the sweat it takes to gain self-determination. I hope you will reward a man who has decided to quit hiding behind the fatal blind belief that it's all in your hands. Then Zahn's boots were my size. I was ready to wear him. Note to self: to agnostics. Just because it says anonymous doesn't mean it has no author. I accepted the offer and immediately shaved my head. Why? Well, I could tell you that it was my vision for the character, or that I knew if I did, it would the studio, and I was looking for a fight, but really it was about the fact that, like I said, I was losing my hair. I had recently gotten turned on to a hair restoration product called Regenix that required twice-a-day topical applications. I also had read that a good school shape can improve the chances of thicker regrowth. So being a man who appreciates the value of vanity, if I was playing Van Zahn, he was going to have a shaved head. I don't know if you've ever shaved your head before, but if you have, you know it can be pretty damn gnarly under there. I mean, I had dents in my cranium, a psoriasis patch, and my scalp was chalk white. The paparazzi got a shot of my freshly shaved nugget the day after I did it, and that photo was in People magazine the next week. Soon enough my phone rang. You did not shave your head. An ominous whispering voice stated, for the sake of privacy, I'll leave his name off the page, but he was a top studio executive with a very large financial investment in Reign of Fire. Yes, I did. I said bluntly, no, you didn't. I refuse to believe this, Matthew, you just wore a bald cap as a prank. I know it again, stating not asking. No, I shaved my head. He hung up that afternoon. The front desk delivered a handwritten letter to my room. It read, in our talk this morning, Mr. McConaughey. You refused to admit that you had in fact not shaved your head. If you are in denial of this fact, please come clean so we can proceed on the journey of making this film together. If in fact it is true that you shaved your head, this would be a tragedy. A major misstep and an act that may bring you very bad karma. Yeah, he underlined and put in bold print. Bad karma. Well, I thought I ought to kick this guy's for throwing the karma shade, but the shaved head sounds like a real deal breaker. Fight I was looking for, got it. I've learned a few things about the Hollywood hustle over the years. For starters, it's better to play your own game in the business of Hollywood than to do your business playing Hollywood game. You have to get the joke. And the joke is, nothing's personal, from the I love yous to the unreturned phone calls when your last picture didn't perform. They will pick you up in a limo, but you might have to catch a cab home. It's not personal, it's just business. That bad karma threat? It wasn't personal, but it was arrogant, cavalier, and in very poor taste. It was time to trump his gesture. Note to self: superstitions. The other day I went into a roadside quick mart and bought a candy bar and a beer. The total came up to 666 on the register, so I paid the cashier and left a penny in the need. One take one, got one. Give one saucer. Touché. There was a big Hollywood industry party coming up that weekend. All the top executives and bigwigs would be there, and most likely Mr. Bad Karma as well. I bought a custom-cut three-piece Gucci blue suit that matched my eyes, attend my pale head poolside for 4 hours a day for the next 5 days. Then I greased my now beautifully brown scalp with some oil knot of mink until it was so shiny it would have made Dwayne Johnson jealous. Then I went to that party. I didn't see Bad Karma. I didn't have two people noticed, especially the ladies, and people noticed them noticing me the following Monday. My phone rang again. It was Bad Karma calling. It scared me at first, but I've had a change of heart. Matthew, I love the shaved head. You look original and so handsome. I love it. I put a pin in the saucer. Green light. Note to self. Some people want the AC on in the gym so they won't sweat. I wear my beanie in July, so I will. I had 2 months to prepare and train to become my man fans, and I needed isolation, so I decided to go out to my brother's ranch, Local Pilotus, in West Texas, 17 miles outside of the nearest town of 518 people. Very secluded, 1,500 acres, hot as hell in the middle of summer. A perfect place to prepare to slay dragons. Next up was devising my own original Dragon Slayer mind, body, and spirit daily workout regime. What would the Dragon Slayer do? How to Dragon Slayer train? I made a plan that would be executed in the mid-July 108-degree weather. 1. Take a double shot of tequila every morning at sunrise before I get out of bed. Yeah, dragons, they would do that. Have fire breath to beat the fire breather. Get the insides on fire first thing to start the day to beat the dragon. Be the dragon. Perfect to run 5 miles across the desert daily barefoot. 2.5 miles out, 2.5 miles back. Yeah, right. Toughen up the soles of my feet. I've gotten tender feet now. I wear shoes. I've got to toughen up the soles of my feet. Plus, dragons have tough skin and I have to become more like my prey. Yeah, dragon slayer. Like Van Zon would have tough soles. Ward off infection, brilliant. 3. Keep my heart rate below 60 while standing on the edge of the barn's rooftop overlooking a 40-foot drop onto the concrete below. Yeah, I'm afraid of heights advance and wouldn't be. I'll do it every day until I can stand on my heels with my feet over the edge while holding a resting heart rate in the low 50s. Yeah, that's what I do. Aces 4. Run out into the pastures every night at midnight and tackle sleeping cows. Yeah, I'm going to full-on tackle cows. Knock him off there. Seed I'll get thick, burly, strong. Yeah, to dragons they would do. That's what Banzan would do, deal. So how did it go? Well, on the 6th morning I gagged up the double Cuervo shot that was awaiting me bedside at sunrise, then again on morning 7, bad idea done. At midnight on my 9th day, a large bull headbutted me and gave me a concussion as I tried to wrestle him to the ground. Oops. After 11 days of running 5 miles barefoot across the rocky 180-degree hot desert, sand and stones, boister-sized blisters formed on the bottoms of my feet. So big and so bubbled that I couldn't even walk, much less run. Oh, after 2 months of trying, I never got closer than 3 feet from the edge of that barn's rooftop, and even then my heart rate never got lower than 125. Nice try, McConaughey, my Dragon Slayer workout regime had failed miserably. But the upside was that I experienced a lot of pain as any good Dragonslayer would. With my self-inflicted 60-day Dragonslayer boot camp complete, I headed to Ireland to make the movie. Banzan was a blast to inhabit, a warrior without a country and bald with a battle axe. I miss him. Great characters earned my respect, and Banzan was one who didn't so much get the madness out of my system as he made me own more of my own. He elevated my expectations of what it takes to survive. And reminded me that duty is worth more than the vanities of a home field advantage. His tomahawk still hangs on the wall behind my back in my office today. After wrapping 4 months of filming in the wet and cold Irish winter, I was physically and mentally exhausted, and pleased to finally get some rest and mend my bruised and battered body and mind. Spiritually, I was strong, challenging my reliance on God's existence in order to rely more on my own was proving a valuable practice, like the time when my dad moved on. I practice being less impressed, more involved once again. It was 3 days after completing principal photography, and I was getting some much-needed sleep one night in the Morrison Hotel on the north side of the Liffey River in Dublin, Ireland, when I had a wet dream. I was floating downstream on my back in the Amazon River, wrapped up by anacondas and pythons, surrounded by crocodiles, piranhas, and a few freshwater sharks. There were African tribesmen lined up shoulder to shoulder on the ridge to the left of me. As far as my eyes could see, I was at peace. 11 frames, 11 seconds. Then I came. Again, yes, the exact same wet dream I had 5 years earlier. I was sure about 2 things in that dream. 1. I was on the Amazon River, and 2. Those were African tribes. Been on the ridge. It was a sign, having already been to the Amazon and physically proven that it was in fact located in the continent in South America. I knew it was now time to go to Africa. But where in Africa? A couple of nights later, while cross-examining the African Atlas, wondering where in this massive continent the wet dream was calling me to, I was listening to one of my favorite musicians, Ali Farka Touré. Then it came to me. Ali is known as the African blues man. Where is he from? I hop from the couch to grab the CD case with the liner notes. Near Funky Mali, north of Mardi on the Niger River. I'll go find him, I said. It was time to chase down the other half of my wet dream. Note to self. Sometimes which choice you make is not as important as making a choice and committing to it. I got a one-way ticket to Bamako, the capital of Mali, then hitchhiked 9 hours to the port city of Mopti, where I met a guide named Issa who had a boat. I introduced myself as David for anonymity's sake and told him that I was looking for Ali Farka. We set sail upriver toward Neo Funk, the next day. After a four-day trip up the Niger River in a small 4-horsepower outboard motor, dugout canoe called AP Rogue, I arrived at the small river town of Neo Funky, where after 5 hours of searching I found Ollie at his second wife's house. He had no idea who I was other than a traveler from America who was a fan. His second wife prepared lunch for us and we ate in the traditional Malian way, sitting on the floor in a circle around a communal bowl of seasoned rice, serving ourselves with our right hand. Never the left. Ollie was one of my musical heroes, but he was also, unbeknownst to him, my journey's only port of call on the second largest landmass on Earth. The lone geographical coordinate I chose to chase in my dream. 15555.92N359-2616 west the longitude and latitude of Neo Funky. What sign would my stop with him? Give me that might lead me to the meaning of the African tribesmen lined up along the left ridge of my Amazon River wet dream. We ate, he played me some of his songs and Easter translated my passion for his music in the local dialect Bambara. Later I asked him. Why do you only perform in West Africa and France? Why do you not tour in other countries, including America? He solemnly answered. Because there I would be dried. Neither me nor my scent would stick with you. Here I am, wet, both me and my scent stick with you. At the end of the day, we hugged our goodbyes. The niece and I returned to the pirogi destination, unknown. Now, what where does the dream want me to go from here, I thought. Without any solicitation from me, Isa began to speak. Dauda, which means David in Bambara. There is a magical people in Mali called the Dogon. They have an extraterrestrial transmission of knowledge of the cosmological facts of this dollars that they knew long before the development of modern astronomy. They fled to a place called the Bunji Agra Escarpment to escape the Muslim invasion over 1,000 years ago, where they now live in villages along the river's edge. I think this is a good place for you to go down there, a place you will remember, he said. Another celestial suggestion. Remember, I thought. Better to have a scent and be remembered than to have none and be forgotten. That's it. What, yes. Let's go there. We loaded the pirogue and headed up the Niger for a 5-day journey. First north, then east, chased down the rest of my wet dream. On the way to the Bunji Ogara, we stopped in the legendary town of Timbuktu, a center for art and learning. It is a quiet little trade settlement situated just north of the Niger River, on the south side of the Sahara Desert. One night after an afternoon of racing camels in the Sahara ISA, two of his well-educated friend Ali Not Vakatori and Amadou and I were sitting finishing dinner on the veranda. The hotel restaurant when a pretty young lady, about 25 years of age, came strolling through. Having a solicitous look at each table full of males, it was obvious she was a lady of the night and was traveling for business. Oh, this. This is not good, said Ali. This is a Muslim woman and this is not the Muslim way. You do not go and sell your body. This is a disgrace. She should not be doing this. Well, Amida countered, it is not for any of us to judge what someone should or should not be doing. We do not know her particular circumstances, what she does or does not do is not for us to say. The two men went back and forth in this conversation, which grew increasingly animated, passionate, and loud. In what appeared to me to be an argument, I interjected that the first pause in their discussion, you know, I agree with Ali. You know it is not what she should be doing. She is young and she has her health and she should be putting out more effort to have a respectable job rather than choosing prostitution at her young and able age. I believe Ollie is right. I think Justin Ollie, the guy whose side I was agreeing with, snapped at me. It is not about right or wrong, it is. Do you understand? Slightly stunned, I leaned back in my chair sheepishly as Ollie stared at me with sobering vengeance. At last, Amida, whose side I was against, looked at me and asked kindly. Do you understand that? I did. Yeah, I said, I do, sorry. To which I'm a dude. Just as sharply and still holding my gaze. Said, you better be different, not sorry. Wow. He just recited to me a version of what I'd said to myself in Australia when I'd refused to call the Dooley's moment pop a double whammy of African proverbs. They're not trying to win arguments of right and wrong, they're trying to understand each other. That's different. Hey America, we could learn a little something from that, huh? The next morning we continued toward the Bunji Ogara escarpment. Bumper sticker: educate before you indict. The Dogon village in the Bunji Ogara is made up of a small cluster of mud huts. Each settlement is spaced about 8 to 15 miles apart along the river's edge. Upon arrival, the chief greets you at the encampment's border where if he likes what he sees in your eyes, he welcomes you in. If not, you keep walking. I was always welcomed. Having just come off of filming Reign of Fire, I had a shaved head, a big beard, and was in sturdy physical shape. Upon coming to Mali, I told Lisa and anyone who asked me that I was a writer. And a boxer by profession. With no electricity in the Bond Lagra, nobody recognized me from my movies, and they were not very interested in me. Being a writer. They were, however, very interested in the boxer part. Word started preceding my appearance in each village. Strong white man named Dauda is walking these parts. One day after I showed up at a beautiful village called Benjamin, too exhausted from the 14-mile hike to get there, I lay down on the ground to stretch my legs. Two young men soon approached, stood above me, and started talking at me. Not to me. A challenge in their tone, a crowd began to gather. What is it they say? I asked Lisa, who sat near. They say they are the champion wrestlers of the village and want to challenge strong white men named Outer to a match. I continued to stretch on the ground measuring the situation when suddenly the two young men ran away in opposite directions as the crowd worked into a frenzy. I looked up and now standing above me was a large shirtless man, much more able-bodied than the two before and with a burlap bag roped around his waist. He pointed down at my chest, then to his own, then off to the right. The crowd amplified another notch. I turned my head to have a look at what he was referring to, where I saw more excited villagers. All surrounding a big dirt pit. I've been glancing Visa, he smiled. This is Michel. He is the real champion wrestle of village. My heart began racing, the crowd roared. That's when I heard my own voice whisper in my ear. Take the challenge, or you will forever regret not knowing. Leave your scent. Slowly I got to my feet, now standing eye to eye with Michel. I raised my right arm and pointed at his chest, then back at my own. Then I turned and walked toward the big dirt pit. The villagers went. Bumper sticker. Some people look for an excuse to do. Others look for an excuse not to. I had always been a fan of wrestling. I followed the WWF as a kid and had decent leverage skills defending myself as the youngest brother of three, but this was different. I was in the middle of rural Africa, 95 miles from the nearest telephone line, standing in a big dirt pit. In front of a well-built native African man wearing a burlap sack for pants, what were the rules? Could you strike, bite, fight to the last man standing? I didn't know, but I was about to find out. Michel and I stood face to face, the chief of the village circling us. A bead of sweat began to run down the back of my neck when Michel swung his right arm to my left hip and secured his hand to my shorts. Then he looked me in the eye and nodded. I took this to mean I should do the same, so I did and got a firm grip on the left side of his rope waist. He then grabbed a handful of my shorts on the right side of my waist. I mirrored his move, our faces now inches apart. The crowd decibels rising once again. Michel lowered his forehead into the soft spot just below my neck above my collarbone and burrowed his brow, and I followed suit, both arms attached to each other's waist, our foreheads bored into the shoulder girdles of the other ear to ear. We began to back our feet away from each other into an interlaced horizontal plank position. Then dug our feet into the sand, you get anchored. All I could see were two tree trunk thighs bulging in front of me, braced for attack. The chief rested his hands on our heads like a baptism. Then as he quickly lifted them, yelled hot. Which I correctly took to mean ding ding. Round one, head to head. We spun in a few circles measuring the other's might before Michel lifted me up and into him, my chest to his face. Then body slammed me to the ground, knocking the wind out of me, point one for him. The crowd held as he quickly mounted to try and pin me on my back. I swiveled trying to evade his grip. Then I whipped my hips upward and swung my right leg over his head and back under his chin and slammed his head backward to the dirt. One for me, for 3 to 4 minutes we circled. Flipped and smashed each other to the ground, but neither of us was able to pin the other. Finally, the chief stepped between us and broke up the battle, dripping sweat. Now hyperventilating. I raised my hands over my head to try and catch my breath. Blood ran from my neck, mixing with shards of my beard that had been ripped away from my face in the friction. My knees and ankles were bleeding. Michel, with barely a glaze of sweat on him, stood upright staring at me. Not a happy man. That's when the chief held two fingers to this guy in the crowd. The limits of hysteria even further. Face to face in the middle of the ring again, we took our positions, hands to hips, heads, burrowed ear to ear, we dug in and let the baptism begin again. Round 2. Back home in Texas, my advantage as a wrestler was always my strong legs, and here in a big dirt pit in Africa. Opposite Michelle, I was reminded that I was no longer in Texas, more aggressive out of the gate this round. Michelle immediately came on the attack. I slipped his first takedown and drove him to the ground based first, mounting him from behind. I employed the reverse of one of my favorite WWF childhood moves, the Boston Crab. Just when I thought I'd exhausted him, he somehow flipped me off his back, and the next thing I knew I was gasping for air, leg locked between his tree trunk stumps.